This podcast is made possible by Optimizely. Optimizely is the leader in progressive delivery and experimentation. Our platform includes feature flagging, progressive rollouts, and A/B testing. We help your teams release software quickly, then test and learn in production before rolling out to all users. Using the Optimizely full stack platform puts product managers at the center of the product development process, allowing you to de-risk big ideas, make bold bets, and build better products.
Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
We're going to start talking about 21st century companies. Why are we even here talking about corporate social impact? Secondly, we're going to dive into how does product development and product management differ for social impact than it would if you were just running a normal tech product. Then we'll talk specifically, Eric is going to talk about the commitment curve and how you can build different solutions along the commitment curve to try to engage a larger audience. And lastly, the importance of storytelling. So many of the ways that we reach out to people is through storytelling, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So before we dive into actually managing products for social impact, we wanted to talk about being a 21st century company. What does that mean, and why are we here talking about corporate social impact? It's not always been the case that companies cared about social impact. It used to be, like, 1919, right? Henry Ford got turned over by the Supreme Court of Michigan saying that you could not divert company resources to help your employees or to help the community. So it's the idea of shareholder primacy. And we've evolved since then, right? Like the second half of the 20th century, directors of companies were able to direct their resources more as they saw fit. They didn't have to solely stick to shareholder primacy. They would stand up philanthropies, donate money, and this is good. But we have a belief that 21st century companies have to go further. It's not just donating money. Companies aren't separate from society as they're so often portrayed. You have a responsibility to make the world a better place and do that by leveraging your core competencies. So that's why we're so excited to see so many people here today talking about social impact, because more and more companies are looking at it this way. Customers are demanding it, employees are demanding it, and a testament to everybody that you're here. So this quote from Brian Chesky, our CEO, captures it. He says, "Our responsibility isn't just to our employees, our shareholders, or even to our community. It's also to the next generation. Companies have a responsibility to improve society." It's a long way from that Henry Ford decision, right? This is a CEO of a major company talking not about quarter-to-quarter management, but generation-to-generation management. And that's a big deal. But how do you get there, right? Each company has so many things to bring to the table. SpaceX can land a Falcon, you know, rocket ship on a floating barge. Boston Dynamics can have a robot open a door. But how do you leverage these things to make the world a better place? We see more and more companies doing it. Lyft has a program called Relief Rides that's awesome. It's free rides for people who've been impacted by a crisis. So when the polar vortex hits the Midwest, homeless people can get a free ride to a homeless shelter. Question is, what do you have that you can bring to bear on some of the world's greatest challenges? So to find your superpower, think about what do you sell today, right? Why do customers come to you and choose your organization over someone else? What are the customer relationships, everything on your business model canvas that you were able to make money on that you could leverage to help people? It's not always easy to do. And for Airbnb, our hosts actually had to show us what our superpower was, because sometimes from the inside, it's hard to tell. In 2010, a blizzard hit New York City, and Joe Gebbia was actually running customer support. This means he was answering phone calls on his cell phone, because at the time, Airbnb was very small. But one of our hosts was named Stephanie. She was from Harlem, and she was going to and from the airport, picking up people who'd been stranded and were sleeping on the ground, and bringing them to Airbnbs. This spontaneous generosity of hosts would come up again and again and again. In 2011, Hurricane Irene hit the East Coast. And in 2012, when Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, one of our hosts, his name's Shell. Shell is now famous on our team because she started Open Homes for us. She reached out. People have been displaced in New York, and she wanted to host people at her Airbnb for free. And Airbnb would not allow it. You had to charge at least $10 a night. It's like a fraud prevention tool. But she said, I want to be generous. I want to welcome people into my home, and you're stopping me from doing this. And so everyone was like, you're right, this is crazy. And they flew engineers to the East Coast, and they built Open Homes overnight, the ability to host for free. And it looked like this. Now, the pinkish-purplish tags are kind of silly, but this is a super powerful idea. Airbnb's superpower was the technology that could build trust between generous hosts and people in need of temporary housing. So our superpower wasn't just the technology platform. It was really the generous hosts. It's a network of people all around the world who are willing to take a risk and help a stranger. And it's the proof that communities become stronger in times of need when they come together. We never saw this more than when the campfire hit Paradise on November 8th of 2018. It became the deadliest fire in California history. 86 people died, and 50,000 people were displaced. One of those people who was displaced was Melissa. Melissa lived in Paradise. She was pregnant on that morning, and she was taking care of her elderly and disabled father. When she was displaced, she had no home to go back to, and she didn't know what she was going to do next. But she met Cindy. Cindy heard about Open Homes through a local fire department, and she decided to sign up and open her home. Not only did she take in Melissa and her family, she went to the hospital when Melissa's baby was born, and she ended up hiring her to work for her small job. This is the power of bringing people together and the generosity that people have for one another if you can introduce them and form these bonds of trust. Disaster response and recovery. But we thought, okay, we've got technology, we've got a network of generous hosts, who else can we help? So flash forward today and we have three areas that we support. Disaster response and recovery, refugees and asylum seekers, and people who have to travel either for medical treatment or for respite. To date, our hosts have opened their homes to 35,000 guests. And we aim to have housed 100,000 people in the next few years. So we had our superpower, right? We had technology platform, and we had a network of generous hosts. And the question is then, what do we do with it? How do you build this product out? How do we do product for social impact? So now we're going to talk a little bit more about how we develop product for social impact, specifically Open Homes. This pyramid shows the social impact PM pyramid. everything you need.
Trademark.
The foundation is product management fundamentals. There's not a lot that's different fundamentally. Your job is to tackle big problems, help your team be effective, and measure your way to success. But there's a heightened focus when you're dealing with people who are in distress and possibly danger on understanding your user context and respecting the dignity of the people who you're working with. And if you do all this right, impact is your profit. Normally, you're optimizing for profit. In our world, you're optimizing for impact, and that can be a tricky thing to do. So first, product management fundamentals. We're not actually going to go into this very much. There's lots of resources you can find online. We're specifically going to focus on how is product management social impact specific. But I think our guidance here would be set a bold vision, be willing to take risks. You really are there to serve your team and ensure that your team can be as effective as possible in pursuit of that vision. Identify manageable steps on the way there and iterate. And don't be afraid to change paths if you get data back that you're going the wrong way. But we do want to spend some time focusing on users, because although product managers should always put the user first, it's especially important when working with vulnerable or at-risk populations. It's very easy for a product manager or a team to think that you know what's going on. But unless you're in this situation, it can be very, very difficult. So there's a couple things you can do to make sure that you always have the user's needs in mind. First is rigorous on-the-ground research. Going out, talking to people, watching them use your product, and trying to understand their context. Second, work with experts in the field, right? We're relatively new to this space, but lots of people aren't. There's great organizations out there, some of whom may be in the audience today, who have dedicated their lives to this and have this wealth of resource, the wealth of knowledge that you should use. And lastly, representation. It's really important that you build diverse teams that have people who have this lived experience. So for an example of this, I'm going to talk a little bit about some work we did with our partner Cancer Support Community. We wanted to build a booking flow so the Cancer Support Community and the people they were working with could book and charge it back to Cancer Support Community. We built a wonderful flow. You get a beautiful illustrated email in your inbox, click on this link and accept free housing facilitated by Cancer Support Community on our platform. We launched it, we were really excited, and it turned out that 60% of the people who started this flow had to reach out to our customer support team to be able to complete it. It's not scalable, and that's not a good sign that we're helping people. So we dug in, and it turned out that 75% of the people who would start this flow were first-time users to Airbnb. That's a sign that this is different. This is different than who we're used to working with. But it wasn't enough to really understand what was going on. So we went out in the field, and we actually went to where people were making these bookings, and we watched them. And we found out that our beautiful flow was made in a vacuum, and that never exists in a vacuum. These people were booking sometimes in a hospital room. They're booking at a cafe. They're trying to figure out billing. They're trying to figure out how, if, you know, they've got all these new terms coming to them from doctors, and booking travel is one tiny, tiny piece of what's going on in these people's lives. And we needed to recognize that. So when they started to book a flow and they end up on the Airbnb homepage, this is not what you want to be dealing with. This is if you're traveling, you know, you can see lux listings, you can see experiences, do you want to go fishing today? And these people don't want to go fishing. So we had to rethink, what is this person trying to do? What's the environment they're in and how can we make it easier? So the first step was we built a custom resource, because we also found that many of the people who were taking advantage of this program were not familiar with some of, they're not the target audience that tech typically builds for, right? They're not familiar with some core tech items such as filtering, searching, how to interact with the UI like that. So we built a custom offline resource that people could use to help guide them through it. This is at a fifth grade reading level. But explaining your complicated process in a simpler way is not really the best solution. So we're also launching a simplified flow where bookers can enter information and we drop someone right where they need to be. Are you going to get treatment at a hospital in New York? We will center it on that hospital and show you listings nearby that fit exactly what we know you need. So you don't have to do the searching, you just still are empowered to search through listings. Because we looked at actually just showing them a listing, but people actually did like having the choice and that feeling of empowerment in the moment of being able to control where they're going to go stay. So by doing this, we were able to have a 50% reduction in customer support. And this is a pretty rough estimate of customer success, right? Measuring it in your own cost, but it's the first step. We were able to do this because we worked with Cancer Support Community and we work with these partners. In every single space we enter, we work with partners who are in the field. And they know, have all the expertise of how to operate there. And the last piece we wanted to mention was representation. So this is an area of improvement for our team. We are half technologists about and half people who have either worked in this space, come from this space, or have a lived experience. But we're trying to drive it at all levels of leadership. And it's going to continue to be a focus and something that we espouse as well for other people. If you do this right, impact is your profit. Right? As a product manager, a big part of your job is setting metrics, measuring how are you doing. But this can lead you in the wrong direction. Right? If you're optimizing for quantity, that's very dangerous in the social impact space. For us, measuring quantity would be how many people that we housed. And that could be good, or that could be bad. Are you optimizing for short-term stays with lots of people? Are you sure that your housing intervention is actually helpful? So it can be very, very difficult to measure these things. But we've decided to focus on three aspects in our theory of change. When you have a theory of change, you're saying that you are going to have an intervention, and what are the myriad of outcomes that you predict will happen? And sometimes these things can take years and years to measure, such as reduction of generational poverty. For open homes, we're focused on psychosocial well-being, so reduction of stress. And when you're in a dangerous situation, how can we avoid re-traumatizing you by putting you in a shelter? Give you a safe space to collect yourself and your family and plan what's coming next. Financial relief. This is actually one of the easier ones to measure. How does in the short term, how much money did we save you? In the long term, how does financial help at a certain point in time help your family avoid going into debt? Mm-hmm. These ripple effects can be large. And lastly, it wouldn't be Airbnb if we didn't talk about belonging. the fact that there's a host there, the fact that the community is coming to help you in a time where you feel like everything is against you, can be very, very powerful. Measuring these things can be difficult, but when you do and you start thinking about impact and prioritizing impact, it helps you steer your product in the right direction. So even though it's difficult, it's very important that you don't get lost in the numbers. That 100,000 goal, Eric's going to talk later about storytelling, but the 100,000 goal is big, right? We use that to motivate ourselves, but you should never be sacrificing for the number and lose sight of why you're actually doing it. Outcomes over outputs, right? If you're a micro lending company, outputs would be how much money has been donated. If you're focusing on outcomes, it's how many people have you lifted out of poverty. So we're just starting down this path. You have to measure it and try to figure out, you know, a big area for this is inclusion, right? Maybe we're helping a certain population. That's a big area for us because we have an app-based solution, right? Mm-hmm. Are we just helping young people who already have an app and know how to do this? Or are we able to really get these benefits to everyone who needs them?
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of a commitment curve and actually building out a kind of a portfolio of options or ways for people to get involved in your cause area. So in order to talk about this, I wanted to rewind a little bit to our origin story, where Shell opened her place for somebody for free. And if you think about the open homes context, this is really kind of the most extreme use case for us, right? This is somebody who's willingly of her own volition offering a free stay to a stranger in a difficult time, right? And that was awesome for us. That showed us the power, the potential power of the platform. It showed us the generosity of the community that we had. But as we kind of dug in into the platform and started looking to scale the platform, we realized that, you know, not everybody is Shell and not everybody was necessarily able or willing to kind of make that big of a commitment off of that. You know, there's hosts who host and actually need that money to pay their mortgage or further important expenses. There are people that might want to support these cause areas that aren't hosts but are part of the Airbnb community or even not part of the Airbnb community. So as we thought about this a bit more, well, one other thing we realized though is that when people did get involved in this, it oftentimes reported kind of a very transformational experience for them. So once they did get involved, not only did they provide like a great impact to somebody else, but oftentimes kind of reported their own personal, you know, perspective changed or their own personal perspective shifted. So we started to dig in and think about how can we help, you know, get people over this hurdle of participating in the program in some way or the other. And so, So what became clear was that we could reach quite a bit more people if we actually found ways to meet them kind of where they are and get them into the program and hopefully kind of get them more involved over time. And so out of this, we kind of began to look at the concept of at least what we call a commitment curve. So I'll talk through how we think about our open homes commitment curve. I think you could apply this exercise to any kind of product or program. So at the peak for us, like I mentioned, is hosting for free. So there are people out there like Shell who are really altruistic, really passionate, and really willing to go above and beyond and just offer an entirely free stay. And we don't even structure it in our platform yet, but a lot of these hosts don't just provide that stay, but provide a lot of kind of supplementary support in a difficult time for their guests. But for people who might not be able to host for free, we've also started exploring other options, like hosting at a discount, which is obviously a little bit of a lower hurdle. Interesting note about this as well, just like the hosting for free example, we actually saw this happening organically on the program before we ever built something intentionally ourselves. So when we looked during disaster events, looked at nonprofits booking on our platform, oftentimes hosts would kind of organically offer a discount on a paid stay. So there's kind of a natural fit here, and we kind of took that idea and just started building it into the Open Homes program in a bit more of a structured way. But what about people who aren't hosts or who don't have extra space to host? So we started thinking about them as well, and over time looked at other actions like possibly donating to fund a stay, or even something as simple as just like sharing a story on social media, just spreading the word, right? So if you're a donor, you might be able to donate. You might not be able to host yourself, but you might be able to donate and actually fund a discount stay, right? And even if you can't, you know, spare the extra money, at least you can help spread awareness or spread the word. So, you know, building out this kind of portfolio of ways for people to get involved really kind of opened up the space of people that could get involved in our program for us. It went from, you know, City A, City B, City C, basically cities where open homes needed hosts and needed, you know, stays to be happening, to pretty much anyone in the world. Anybody in the world can donate, can share, can take some kind of action. So basically anybody in the world that was interested in supporting somebody in our three program areas could find some way to get involved, right? Creating these different ways to get involved, though, does add some complexity and kind of raises new questions. In our case, you know, having multiple ways to get involved led us to start thinking about, you know, what is the right ask to make at the right moment for a given person, right? And so looking through the example of open homes, oftentimes for us, it depends a lot on the specific person. Are they a host right now, or are they likely to be a host? And also their context, for example, what is their location? So if somebody isn't a host, or we think maybe it's not likely to be a host, maybe we just lead with a donating action up front, right? Even if they are a host, oftentimes we have to ask other questions, right? Like, are they in a location where we actually have need for open home stays, right? Are they in a location where there's an active disaster event, or in the case of medical, are they in a market where there's a major medical facility? So if those things are true, great, we can help get them involved as a host, but if not, there might be other actions that are more appropriate to present to them. And so ultimately, you know, building out these different ways of people getting involved kind of expands our way, I guess you could say expands the overall impact of the program. Each additional action that a person takes, whether it's hosting for free or even something simple like sharing, expands our reach, expands the number of people we can help, and overall expands the impact of the program. That's, you know, kind of the, I would say, the surface level value of this. It's just you can get more people involved, you can have more impact. But there's another kind of positive of this that we think, and this is really, I would call it more of a hypothesis for us right now. I don't think we've fully proven this out, but we have seen a lot of evidence to suggest it, which is that if we can get people involved and kind of meet them where they are, bring them in, help them understand the program, build empathy for the people that the program is serving, hopefully over time we can actually move them up this commitment curve. So, you know, hosting for free, which might have once seemed very scary, very kind of intimidating for a host, once you've hosted for a discount and had a positive experience, maybe had kind of a perspective altering experience, you might come back and look at that and say, oh wow, that seems so easy and natural for me to do now. Or even if you're just a donor and have seen the impact that a welcoming stay can have in a trying time, that might, you know, compel you to look into other ways you can get involved. So we're still proving this out. This is something I'd say we're just in the process of adding all these actions, but I think we've seen a lot of kind of anecdotal and qualitative evidence that this would be the case over time. Cool. So this brings us to our last section, storytelling for impact. So in the last section, we discussed a lot about just within the social impact context, how you're often making requests of people with a non-monetary incentive. You're just asking people to do something out of like the good of their heart, basically. And so when the exchange of money isn't involved, or even if it is involved, if it's not the primary kind of motive, it wasn't like a primary profit motive, what we found is that we needed very kind of different tools to inspire action or get people to get involved. And so one of those tools, or one of those, tools for that is finding ways to communicate our impact. So coming back to these impact concepts that Scott was talking about, you know, a lot of these are kind of fuzzy concepts. They're not super easy to quantify, and they deal with kind of very human, emotional concepts, right? Like psychosocial well-being. Even something like financial relief, at the end of the day, might not be about the specific number of dollars you save somebody, but might be about a longer-term impact, like preventing them from entering a cycle of debt that ultimately has kind of longer-term impacts on their well-being. So to communicate, you know, these concepts, I wanted to talk a little bit about the power of small numbers. So this is not a small number. And I think oftentimes, especially in the tech sector, we like to talk a lot about big numbers, about scale. Clearly, we're no exception to that. You know, we were just talking about how we aspire to house 100,000 people. And you know, these numbers are great. There's a time and place for them, and a context for them, and they appeal to that rational part of your brain, right? It's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Wow, a lot of impact. But if we're looking to appeal to people on the emotional side, I think we also have to talk about small numbers. This is a small number, one, or a big small number. It's large on the screen here. So let's like pause for a second. Let's take a second to think back to, for example, that story, that video that Scott showed of the people affected by the earthquake in Mexico, right? Just, I want you to take a second to reflect and think about, you know, how you felt while you watched that story, right? And how meaningful that was for them, that somebody opened their home to them in their time of need. Okay, now another big number throughout their 100. Let's say, for a second, hypothetical exercise, I tell you all that 100 stays like that happened during that event in Mexico. That's great. You might feel better with that new piece of information. Do you feel 100 times better? Right? I think the reality is probably no, right? And the reality is that, you know, there's a limit to our capacity to feel an emotional response, right? It doesn't just scale linearly with big numbers. And so even though you might rationally understand that there's a lot more to be excited about and happy about when you see that number 100, emotionally you don't necessarily feel that much of a difference. So this, we believe, is when, you know, telling a really compelling story about a small number of people can have a really big impact, especially emotionally on people. Earlier, Scott was talking about superpowers and kind of identifying your superpowers. Kind of luckily for us, storytelling also happens to be a superpower of Airbnb that we've kind of built up over the years. Airbnb as a platform has always led to some pretty amazing real-world stories, and so it was a superpower that we kind of built over the years from a pretty early age. And because of that, it's been one that we've started to leverage a lot within this context. So in the case of medical and refugee, basically all of our guests come through partners, right? And so actually a lot of these people go through very rigorous vetting in the first place. So for example, a refugee resettling to the US goes through a ton of very rigorous background checks before we even let them in the country. So it varies from program area to program area, but a lot of the times we actually depend on our partners to help do that vetting of need or upfront vetting. So we're kind of getting into Q&A, which is timely because I was just about to wrap up anyway and open it up for Q&A. But just wanted to summarize real quick, you know, what we chatted about as a refresher before Q&A. So we chatted a little bit about the role of companies in the 21st century, how we believe that that is changing, and how companies have to think much more about the impact you're having on society, not just on your shareholders, for example. We talked a little bit about product for social impacts. You know, in that context, impact is your profit, right, if you're making the analogy to business, and how deeply important it is, in particular, to understand your users, because oftentimes you're that much farther away from their personal experience. Talked about the concept of a commitment curve and really building out a portfolio of options and ways for people to support your cause. And then lastly, talked a little bit about the power of storytelling to communicate impact and to inspire people to action.
This podcast is made possible by Optimizely. To learn more about how you can get started with progressive delivery and experimentation, visit www.optimizely.com.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.